Thank you for tuning into this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about this podcast, go to the website lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be on that website. If you look down in the description of this episode, you will see a link to the website and everything else you need to know about this project as well. Here's the episode. In this episode, I speak with Alexander Reed Ross and Shane Burley. Alexander is the author of Against the Fascist Creep. Shane is the author of Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. And both of these individuals are journalists. They've done extensive work in organizing, whether it's through anti-fascist work, labor rights, all kinds of things like this. They've done extensive work in that realm. And so I've spoken with Shane. This is our fifth interview, I think we decided here. At the beginning, I mentioned that. But this is our fifth interview. And Alexander, I haven't spoken to him before. So it was really good to get both of them on. I know that they've collaborated quite a bit together. They've written articles together and other projects as well. So it was good to get both of them on. And what I really wanted to do in this interview was to discuss, at first to discuss an individual, and then to expand outwards and to sort of identify the place this individual is in the media environment, the broader context of how news and how current events are portrayed in the what we'd call the mainstream media, the corporate press, the capitalist press. What we have seen over and over again is that when it comes to certain events, a lot of different kinds of events, the mainstream media tends to, this is very generalized, I know this isn't always 100% the case, but in a very general sense, there's often a lack of context to events. So for instance, in this very particular case with this interview with Shane and Alexander, we discussed the case of Andy Ngo, and he's a former editor for Quillette, which is a conservative kind of op-ed publication for the most part. They've been known to publish some rather inaccurate, I would say, or problematic articles relating how they have tried to confront the left and anti-fascist Antifa, right? Andy Ngo has played a big part in this, in sort of misrepresenting the actions and views of anti-fascist demonstrators and activists. But the whole point of this really isn't even about Andy as much as it is about the sort of media environment. After this sort of scandalous event that happened a few months ago, where he's at a rally and he had some milkshakes thrown at him and he was humiliated, you know, he was being interviewed by major publications, he was being discussed, and it put Antifa in a very kind of negative light, I would say. And what the thing that came out of that also was that, you know, Andy Ngo was labeled a journalist, when in fact the things that he has done, and this is what Shane explains here in the beginning, he's not a journalist. The way that the mainstream media lacks an ability, it seems, to provide the kind of context required to understand figures like Andy Ngo, who are providing kind of a false narrative. And so they label him a journalist without actually doing the research to find out if he actually is a journalist. And so what is frightening here is in relation to Alexander's work and his book Against the Fascist Creep, you know, how can fascist ideas and ideologies seep their way into the public consciousness more broadly? So for instance, when Donald Trump became president, when he ran for president, the Overton window shifted because he was saying things that had to be addressed. And it just sort of allowed certain groups of people to feel more comfortable to express their views that are rather racist, misogynistic, hyper-nationalist, all of that, right? The fascist creep kind of manifests itself in all kinds of ways. And the far right is very, very good. These organizations are very, very good at finding ways to seep in, so to speak. And so I have Alexander and Shane kind of unpack this whole thing. And so really, this is just a way to get an overview of where we're at regarding anti-fascism and the rise of fascism, like real homegrown fascism here in the United States, and what it looks like, what it sounds like. And so even if someone like Andy Ngo isn't a fascist, he and other people like him are opening, kind of cracking open the door a little bit for more fascist and far-right ideologies to kind of bleed their way into the public consciousness and the public discourse. And that is very dangerous. We know where that leads. This isn't something to sort of brush off as nothing. This is a big deal. And so we discuss all of this in this episode. So I really thank Shane and I really thank Alexander for coordinating a time to get together with me and have this discussion. If you want to learn more about Alexander, go to his website, alexanderreedross.net. You can also find him on Twitter at @AReedRoss. And also just go check out his book, Against the Fascist Creep, and along with Shane Burley and his book, Fascism Today. Both of those have been published at AK Press. So go to AK Press, provide links to those down in the description as well. And also, if you want to learn more about Shane, go to his Twitter, Shane_Burley1. That's the number one. You can also go support Shane. He just started a Patreon rather recently. Go to patreon.com/ShaneBurley. Go support his work. He's doing incredible stuff. Please enjoy this interview with Alexander Reed Ross and Shane Burley. All right, so we've got Shane Burley and we've got Alexander Reed Ross. Thank you guys both for agreeing to do this at the same time with me. I've been wanting to do something like this for a little while. I know I've had Shane, I've had you on like, I think we figured out like 5 times. This is like the 5th interview I've had with you on the podcast. And Alexander, I've been meaning to talk with you this whole time and it's just, I don't know, just why things happen the way they do. But I figured this would be a good time to have both of you on because I know that both of you are friends. You both do very similar work, or you're at least in the same kind of field of research and journalism and all of that. And I know you two have collaborated on articles together. You've done speaking events together. So I felt like this would be a good opportunity for all of us to kind of have a conversation about your work and to sort of suss out, I think, what's kind of happening. And as I remember Shane, last time we spoke was 2 or 3 months ago. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was right after the mass shooting in New Zealand. And I mean, at the beginning, I was sort of joking about how every time we talk to each other, it's always some really fucked up thing that's happening in the world that we have to talk about, you know, regarding right-wing violence and all this stuff. And so the past couple months, these things have been happening, several things that I can just think off the top of my head. And I had to kind of stop myself from contacting Shane or contacting you, Alexander, for an interview because I'm like, I just need to wait and let this settle for a moment and then we can have this discussion. So, I'm really pleased that both of you are here. So the theme that I want to get at here for this interview is I wanted to talk about this figure, this individual named Andy Ngo, who was apparently he's left or resigned or was fired or something happened. He was working for the publication Quillette, and he made something of a career out of targeting or speaking about Antifa as if they're just these, you know, ultra-violent, borderline, if not borderline, than actual terrorist groups of people, you know, roaming the streets of Portland or wherever. And that people that are advocating for free speech are, you know, being attacked by these horrible people. And he's made something of a career almost out of this. And there have been several things that have happened rather recently. And so I wanted to use him, not to talk about him specifically, but to use him as an example of the media environment, the way in which we call the capitalist or corporate media has really done a poor job of vetting these people, whether it's Andy Ngo or other people like him, and really getting to the root of what his real work is about. He was labeled just recently, please correct me, I can't remember what publication it was, but he's been cited as something like an independent journalist or a conservative journalist, but the term journalist was attached to what he does. And digging even just a little bit under the surface of what he does, you don't get the impression that he's a journalist. He's something else entirely. So I don't know who I want to pass this to first. Maybe both of you can maybe build on top of this, but bring me up to speed about who he is, where did he come from, and what is the grift here? Maybe I could ask Shane first, and if Alexander, please feel free to jump on whenever you feel appropriate to add anything to that. Yeah.
Yeah, so Andy Ngo is kind of well known around here in Portland where I'm at. He also lives. I think his career started when he was going to graduate school at Portland State University, the public university in Portland, and he was fired from the student paper for essentially taking a comment out of context from a Muslim student, making it sound as though they were saying some kind of like outrageous Sharia law kind of thing. And the start of his career is what he did right in the kind of wake of that, which was to get an article published in the National Review, the right-wing publication National Review, basically claiming to be a victim of campus, you know, culture of silencing people. And that basically started his entire model of a career. So I generally, when someone generally calls themselves a journalist, I use, even if I think they're poor at it, I usually just give them that label, fine, you can still be a journalist and just be bad at it. But it's really hard because what he does isn't understood traditionally as journalism by the standards we understand journalism to be. So if someone's a journalist, they generally do things that look like reporting, even if it's opinionated, it still kind of looks like fact gathering and things like that. But what Andy Ngo does professionally is actually more like write op-eds and reactive things and kind of think pieces that are put together with kind of poorly laced up arguments, usually focusing on punching down as much as possible. So, for example, he wrote an op-ed once discussing that this idea that there was Muslim no-go zones in London. This was roundly condemned right afterwards as being inaccurate and kind of just fear-mongering. He spends a lot of time trying to weed out what he calls hate crime hoaxes, and this specifically is going after trans women, the murder of trans women, particularly trans sex workers, and trying to look at each case and prove that it wasn't actually because of their gender identity. It was because of whatever other, you know, condition he thinks what it usually was. Usually it was, some kind of racist undercurrent to what his argument. And specifically going after Antifa, basically anti-fascist activists, trying to prove that they really are the violent ones, that it's right-wing activists that are kind of sheepish and being attacked by this left-wing militant mob culture. Known for blowing things out of proportion, for mislabeling facts, for using a lot of kind of baiting language and really singling out individuals, particularly just activists or people on the street that don't really have much social clout and don't really need to be singled out for any particular reason. But I think what Andy Ngo does is a lot bigger than this story just about Andy Ngo. He is a very kind of well-tailored version of a right-wing media machine based entirely around outrage and getting people really worked up with misconceptions about really big issues, whether it's, you know, campus culture or it's issues around gender and identity or immigration. Andy Ngo really traffics in this sense of aggrievement of white displacement, this kind of false sense of white identity, and this idea that things are about to collapse. And that feeds really his entire career. It's a money-making model. It's a way that he moved as a person with almost no credentials whatsoever to being an editor at a large publication, even though, as anyone can read his stuff, doesn't seem to have much editorial background. It's an entire model of building up a kind of persona online. And so Andy Ngo, in a way, is a really kind of modern media figure. It's a person whose career isn't based on any kind of credentials as we would conventionally understand them, but instead a person whose name has become synonymous with this kind of battle over the culture.
Hmm. Alexander, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I mean, I think that there's just a couple of illustrative details as well in his sort of record. If you go back to some of his articles before he was fired from the school newspaper at Portland State, he did one interesting article that was sort of exposing a fascist group that was flyering around the campus. But in the context of that article, he sort of put forward this kind of weird sort of equivalency to black nationalists. It was kind of a random insertion in that article that really didn't make a lot of sense, but it kind of showed you how he wanted to kind of play up his sort of reasonable persona as somebody who calls out hate on both sides or something like that. And I think that when he did kind of get fired or let go or leave the Portland State Vanguard, I think it did kind of change things for him. And I think Shane's exactly right. You know, he kind of got attention for it and realized that he would have this kind of platform as a sort of member of the nation, intellectual dark web or what have you. And it was really that kind of milieu that he really started to float into. And you really can't sort of separate the rise of Andy Ngo from his involvement in this student group at Portland State called the Free Thinkers. You know, and they helped bring James Damore, the Google bro, to Portland State. And their MO was, you know, we're not left or right. We're just sort of like a think tank, you know. And the professor who sort of sponsored the group, Robert Boghossian, I think his name is in the philosophy department and is currently, I guess, being investigated for breaching institutional ethics for a hoax that he did. And, you know, the whole thing, you know, his hoax was attempting to sort of blow the doors off of PC culture in academia and so on. So the whole thing is just sort of like it's this notion that reason itself opposes the SJWs, you know? And so there's a big kind of, moral and ethical sense of high ground that, you know, we're just the ones who are open to debating ideas and the left are the ones who are trying to shut it all down, you know? And that's really kind of where Andy sort of sat for a long time is within this kind of discursive field of a neutrality. And I think that things started to shift. He got space in the Wall Street Journal. He got involved in all of these decidedly far right protests in Portland, very much from their perspective. And then his linking up with Quillette really sort of sealed the deal as far as his travels from this sort of like weird pseudo neutrality toward this, you know, far more virulent far right sort of ethos where you're actually now dealing with biological racism and phrenology and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, you know, I just want to pick up something you said, Sasha, is this kind of pseudo neutrality, because I feel like there's a kind of political space of its own that kind of stands out as its own kind of methodology in a way. So like we're talking about the intellectual dark web. So these are people like Steven Pinker. I think, you know, was it Pierre Boghossian at Portland State? And then people have centered around Joe Rogan, Sam Harris, New Atheists, people like that. And so like the argument from these folks is that, you know, actually they're quite leftist in a lot of ways, but really they just want open debate and open conversation. Do we not talk anymore? Can't we hear each other anymore? And, you know, maybe it's actually the left that's actually silencing the real discourse and the real egalitarianism of sharing ideas. And what this does is something fundamentally different than a lot of other kind of far-right politics, because it's not always arguing in favor of far-right positions. Instead, what it does is it banks itself on attacking the opposition to the far-right and trying to undermine all the tools that people have, the sense of identity people have on making social progress or claims and things like that, and then to open up a critical space where little tidbits of far-right ideas can come in. So someone like Sam Harris can come in and start kind of maybe lifting the veil off race and IQ ideas, or someone like Steven Pinker can start to suggest that women maybe not have as high of IQs. And since they've established themselves as really just kind of liberal-leading free speech advocates, it kind of is able to traffic a little bit more since it's actually just a small portion of what they're saying. And I think that's a lot of ways what Andy Ngo does is he positions himself, well, look, you know, I'm an immigrant, a person of color, and a queer person, and I'm experiencing life with a lot of intersecting oppression. And he uses that in a lot of conversations. But then what he's doing professionally is almost exclusively focusing on punching down as much as possible, looking at, making people who are victims of hate murders look questionable, blaming victims, reshaping video footage so that it basically only looks like the leftists are attacking. And so I think it's a unique political methodology all on its own that's in a lot of ways very, very pointed.
Mm. Yeah, and so I want to fit this in with this idea of, you know, the fascist creep in the way, of course, Alexander, that you've, of course, explored in your work. And I know, Shane, of course, you've done the same. But to sort of speak to this idea of the fascist creep in which fascist ideology, fascist memes, things like this get into the public discourse or the broader political discourse. And, you know, I mean, one big example of this, of course, is Trump and the election of Trump and all of that. You know, we've seen the discourse has shifted and as a result of his campaign and him becoming president. But this, like with anything, is a symptom of a deeper thing that's happening. So I want to talk about how using this example of Andy Ngo, and again, as I mentioned at the beginning, it's not as much about him. I just want to use him as an example of the ways in which more far-right ideas can bleed their way into the discourse and without even people even realizing it's happening. And it's sort of a dangerous trend that at least I have observed. And so I want to ask about the event where there was I mean, my timeline is so messed up right now. I feel like it was a month ago or like 2 months ago, but there was a rally or some sort of protest that he was there and he was filming Antifa, some anti-fascist protesters. And at some point things escalated to the point where he had milkshakes thrown at him, silly string. He alleged, I don't know how true this is or how bad it really was. I assume he probably was hit and maybe injured, but he claimed he had head trauma, as a result of this. And one thing I started seeing is he started getting a lot of donations directly to him, and he was kind of milking it from what I could tell, and sort of claiming, and hashtag Antifa terrorists was trending after this event. And I just want to fit this event within this bigger thing that we're seeing here where grifters like Andy Ngo are furthering this agenda, I guess, or this sort of malevolent cause to bring about. So this is what I want to specifically point to here. As soon as that event happened, you had mainstream media pundits, journalists saying, one, they're claiming that Andy Ngo is somehow automatically a journalist and that Antifa is out of control and leftist violence is out of control, and focusing completely on this narrative. And this was being spouted off in mainstream press. And so now there's this narrative that's being concocted that has really strong far-right elements to it. So I want to use this as an example to discuss this idea of the fascist creep and the ways in which our sort of corporate media environment is actually not totally, but it has some room for this type of ideology to make space. Do you know what I mean? So I guess I would ask Alexander first about that. Like, what is your study and your research into how fascist ideologies kind of bleed their way into common public discourse in whatever context it is? What do you sense from these events regarding Andy Ngo and all of that, regarding the fascist creep?
Yeah, I think that there is a major susceptibility that, you know, media has, let's say mainstream media has to sort of currents and ideas that aren't well vetted, even when facts that they report are vetted. And so they'll go with this story of independent journalists, this, that, and the other, and they won't really understand the context behind it. And so they end up having a poorly kind of pointed article that still has some factual information in it. And when you talk about Andy Ngo and June 29th, one thing you have to recognize is the context here. This is related. It was billed by the far right as the Battle of Portland Part 2. Referencing last year, June 30th. Ironically, that was probably the fiercest fighting that Portland has seen between the far right and the left. And during that protest, I actually witnessed somebody being stomped on the ground by seven different people while I was reporting on it. And I intervened to pull them off and got punched in the face by a Proud Boy wearing a mask. And still, you know, that person luckily survived, but the meme that went viral from that protest was actually an anti-fascist protester being punched out. So they used that meme. Andy himself used that meme to effectively promote this June 29th protest as the Battle of Portland Part 2, sort of, you know, stoking the fire by saying, you know, is Antifa, you know, going to show up? Like, do they have the courage or whatever? And so that was really sort of unsettling, and it showed to a point Andy's own involvement and the side that he's obviously chosen. And of course, the media didn't pick up on any of that context because they didn't, you know, call any of us to talk to us about what's been going on here in Portland. They sort of pulled the trigger on this sort of knee-jerk reflexive reaction, largely, I think, as a part of, you know, their reflexive sort of upsetness with regards to social unrest. You know, I think that when they see things that they don't think are familiar, then they sort of lash out, and they're most comfortable with, you know, both sides are wrong. We just need to reestablish order. Where are the police? That kind of narrative. And that's what Andy's been spoon-feeding them, you know, and he's been going forward with all of this stuff about how violence is bad and we need to stop political violence. And he's been one of the main agitators, from my view, here in Portland. So in that effect, I think that the media can play a significant role in providing an accelerant for trying to destroy Antifa and just anti-fascist action, as opposed to, you know, clamping down on what are effectively far right wing raids on the city of Portland in order to plunder its coffers.
Yeah. I think it's important to unpack a little bit about what happened and what he has said, and then what was printed about it, because I think this kind of exposes the weird complexity about how we make meaning out of events. And Arun Gupta talked about this in his article for Jacobin about Andy Ngo, in the way that Andy Ngo has taken what are seemingly minor events and turned them into a flip narrative. So, you know, when Andy Ngo was on Joe Rogan, talking about him being assaulted and this and that, Joe Rogan brought up this incident whereby anti-fascist protesters attacked a Trump supporter in his car who was elderly. Sounds pretty bad. The problem is that that's not even remotely what happened. What happened was there was a Black Lives Matter protest. Someone plowed into the crowd. They had a slight altercation. Someone hit the side of the car and they left. It was a non-event. Except Andy Ngo captured a small amount of video, trumped it up. It played really big in right-wing media. And so now this was a shibboleth moment, the time that the elderly Trump supporter was attacked by protesters. And that's a really easy narrative. That's what people remember from that. They don't remember the context. They don't remember how just incredibly minor the situation was. So let's fast forward to Andy Ngo's experience at this last protest. So this protest was a counter demonstration to the Proud Boys and a Patriot Prayer side project. They were both having events that day. Counter organizers create a kind of Carmel-esque atmosphere in a park, and then we're going to kind of march and that kind of thing. So Andy Ngo shows up, as he often does, putting his camera in people's faces, you know, doing things that generally get people a little riled up. Then some random people that were there that happened to have masks on got in an altercation with them. None of us saw it, so who knows how bad it was. I don't have a reason to disbelieve him necessarily, even though he's provided no evidence of it. But the reality is, that's all that happened. A person who's kind of provocative with another crowd of people got in an argument with some people, and that's about it. Antifa wasn't attacking journalists. There's not actually a track record of that. Except when Andy reframed it as that, a lot of media outlets re-understood this in the narrative of their kind of a victim narrative where they're always being attacked at protests and things like that, where protests are kind of difficult spaces to be in, and when being a journalist is legitimately difficult right now. And so he was able to reframe a really minor event as a politically motivated attack on journalism itself. That these people are really, literally coming after journalists, and they're laying siege to the city in doing so. Now, this isn't what happened. This isn't what happened to Andy. It's not what happened to the larger crowd. But it's now how that event is understood nationally. And that feeds in a lot of feelings people have. A lot of feelings of this is movements I don't recognize, playing to like situations of fear about immigration and about the left and about young people and all kinds of things. It speaks to that. He's able to trigger every one of those things in this story that he's retold. And it doesn't matter if it wasn't real. You know, within hours, really, of this incident and Andy Ngo's framing of it, Getty Images and a number of reporters identified Rose City Antifa as the people who did this attack. Now, there's no evidence that that's true. They never said they did. There's just nothing in any of the videos that would suggest that. There's lots of people in masks because it's a protest, and protesters happen to have people in masks. But that was just assumed. He framed the narrative, and people accepted it as just as wholesale fact. And that has gone through this entire coverage of this, and that's really the story of Andy Ngo's career.
Hmm. And there was also this claim that they were using quick dry cement and they were mixing it in with these milkshakes, and that and there was no evidence of that either. So there's just seems to me with these incidences, there's almost purposely a lot of misinformation is fed into it. And so these narratives can be concocted out of almost thin air using, you know, footage, for instance, that's completely out of context. For instance, again, I'm forgetting the name of this. There was like a week or two ago, there was another rally in Portland, another protest. And there was an incident where it showed a bus full of, I can't remember the name of the group, but a far right group in these buses. And the video that Andy Ngo shared, just at the very beginning of the video, it shows what looks like Antifa or a member of the group throwing a hammer into this bus and attacking them. And he's like, look at these people, how violent they are. And then somebody under it was like, actually, this is the full video. And they attacked first. That was their hammer. They took it away from them. Like, just even 2-3 seconds of context added to the beginning of that video changed the entire narrative. And it just shows to me just how that, you know, how that all kind of works. And it's scary because, again, when you have mainstream popular media kind of parroting or perpetuating this narrative that Andy Ngo or whoever is a victim and that he's just an independent journalist trying to do his job and he's getting mercilessly attacked by these Antifa terrorists, you know, it completely clouds the whole discussion and it makes it very difficult to kind of know, well, maybe not for everybody, but for many people that are outside of the situation to really know what's going on. And the context is very clouded. So
yeah, there's another kind of detail about that. That group was actually the American Guard, which is a fascist organization that's associated with the Proud Boys. It was founded by Brian James, who came out of the outlaw Hammerskins and formed the Vinlanders Social Club, which was an extremely violent Nazi skinhead gang that used this sort of like white heritage and European civilization rhetoric as opposed to open neo-Nazi rhetoric in order to get more followers. But all their members are covered in white nationalist tattoos and so on. Interestingly, Brian James went from the Vinlanders straight into the Proud Boys, where he headed up their Indiana chapter for quite a while before forming the American Guard as kind of like a spillway for the most insane members of the Proud Boys who just couldn't keep their real feelings under wraps. And so their very presence there at that protest, and Joey Gibson knew it and admitted that he knew it on video and said he was fine with it, really speaks to the way that Joey himself and the InfoWars crowd that accompanied him and helped organize this event that just happened are acting as stewards for fascism. Mm-hmm. They themselves might not be, you know, committed fascists, but they certainly acknowledge and understand their role in helping fascists organize and move into the streets and get into violent confrontations with the anti-fascists. So that's just a really kind of important piece of this puzzle where Andy comes out, you know, completely in their defense with, you know, video that is very partial to the fascist side. And now we have more information showing members of the American Guard fully bragging about having hit people with the hammer and brandishing a knife. So, you know, the whole story is actually pretty damning in this instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to point to something here, which is, I just want to kind of not close exactly, but to just talk about Andy Ngo, because he kind of skyrocketed there for a bit as a result of that, you know, horrible attack against him. and then recently, I mean, he left or was fired or something happened because he, as we mentioned, worked for Quillette. Now he's no longer a part of the staff. There was a video that was released. There was an article actually published in Portland Mercury in which an individual who was kind of, I don't know how to say this exactly, kind of going undercover with these groups, these far right groups, kind of just to film them and sort of see what's going on and expose them, had filmed an incident where a group of, I guess, again, sorry, I'm so bad with names. I don't know how you guys know all these things. You must really dig deep into this, but like all these different little subgroups and these things, it's just like hard to keep them all straight in my head. But whoever this was, this group of far right provocateurs or whatever they were walking down the street. Andy Ngo was with them in the video, and they were talking about instigating violence and a riot of some sort. And he was just kind of there with them. He didn't film it. He didn't even, he just sort of went along with it. And so it seems to me that that video has been a part of his, I guess, at least recently, some of the more difficulties that he's had in sort of working with Quillette. So if I could ask a little bit about that, because I want to move on past him, but I just want to kind of mention that just to sort of give a bigger picture of who he is and who he is associated with.
This is a video with Patriot Prayer where they're planning their attack on May Day.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So this happened several weeks before. Patriot Prayer came out after May Day events. It's May 1st, International Workers' Day. So Cider Rise is kind of a local bar. A lot of people who are involved in anti-fascist organizing or community organizing in general came out to kind of have like an after party. And so this has been kind of a move from Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys a lot in the last year, was to kind of come to social spaces and try to instigate fights while live streaming it. And so there was a Joey Gibson shows up, there's an altercation, a woman's hit with a baton and it fractures her spine. And it's a kind of a major incident. And it's what led in a lot of ways to charges later against Joey Gibson and members of Patriot Prayer, and also some lawsuits. And so Andy Ngo was there filming, and it seems like what a coincidence. Andy Ngo shows up 5 or 10 minutes directly before Joey Gibson does. And it seems like quite a coincidence for someone who's not coordinating, except later video comes out of them together, and it looks like they're actually coordinating and organizing. Shortly after that video is released, and the person who shot the video kind of confirms, yeah, that I think Andy Ngo was collaborating with these people, all of his information about him being associated with Quillette is dropped. And Quillette then says, oh, that has no reason to do with it. Andy has moved on to bigger and better things, that kind of thing. But it certainly doesn't look good. I know that there's a lot of people wondering if this means that he'll be indicted as a co-conspirator. Because in all reality, he's played this point of plausible deniability for a very long time. But the issue ends up being, is he actually a part of that group or not? Is he a journalist reporting on it or not?
Mm, okay. Yeah, I just wanted to kind of point to what just happened very recently. And I want to point to an article that both of you co-wrote together for The Independent. And the title of that was, I Was the Target of Alt-Right Death Threats Across the Internet. Here's What Happened Next. And this actually brings in Quillette again, because there was an article they published in which several writers, several journalists were named. And apparently there was also some other, I think Andy Ngo was actually a part of this as well, but sort of naming specific people, including, I know Alexander, you were named, and Shane, I can't remember if you were named in that as well. But the idea here is that in that article, both of you discuss how, you know, once that was out, once they started kind of
labeling certain journalists as, oh, they're Antifa or whatever, or very sympathetic and working on their side. There was apparently a video that was released by, was it Adam Waffen or something associated with Adam Waffen, the sort of neo-Nazi group, and they were like basically creating a kill list, naming journalists. So I just want to point to that because, I mean, you kind of think about what the implications are of trying to write articles like that and frame it in that way, and how, you know, when you put people out like that, even if it's entirely bullshit journalism or whatever you want to call it, there are dangerous groups of people that are actually willing to engage in violence against certain people. So I wanted to ask you both about your maybe personal experiences, or maybe if you don't want to talk about that, but just sort of frame it in a way that we can kind of understand what's at stake here when publications like Quillette are acting really irresponsibly in how they publish their information. I don't know, Alexander, if you had anything you wanted to share on that first.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Andy who actually brought Shane into it. I think that Shane was relatively clear, but then Andy brought him into it in some tweet.
And yeah, that's right. I wasn't named in the original article. Andy, no, just decided to single me out after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the tweet was remarkably similar to an article that was published in an Australian white nationalist website called XYZ. So it really looks like Andy just pulled some information from XYZ and posted it on Twitter as sort of like a follow-up to this kind of really bizarre article that they had, which, I mean, I know that they like vetted the article through an editorial process, and Andy wasn't the editor who vetted it, but the editor who did vet it was not like a data journalist and doesn't have a lot of experience with data journalism. And the article itself was completely torn apart by an actual sort of data specialist named Erin Gallagher. She just kind of went through every single thing that was wrong with the article and sort of tore it to shreds. But the important thing here is not even necessarily like the fact that the journalism was significantly flawed. It's really the two things. First of all, you just can't release a list of people to the far right and expect everything to be hunky-dory. Like, the far right is completely, you know, stocked to the brim with, you know, mass murderers. I mean, the whole scene is encouraging this kind of tilt toward civil war in the United States, and the most violent part of the scene is actually, you know, 4chan, 8chan, sort of like school shooters and you know, mass murders. So you know, they're really playing with fire, even though they pretend that this is a very intellectual type of thing. And, you know, so second of all, it's the accusation that matters. The accusation is that, you know, journalists like Jason Wilson from The Guardian, for example, are absolutely biased in favor of Antifa. And, you know, the sort of the support for that is that they're against fascism. Mm-hmm. And you just can't have a litmus test of journalistic neutrality as, well, they're neither for nor against fascism. You know, fascism is imminently hostile to journalism. It's hostile to the truth. It's hostile to fact. And, you know, it has no place in a society where journalism matters. And I think that that's really what threatens them at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think it's good to go back to Andy Ngo a little bit. You know, the person who wrote that original article was not Andy Ngo. The article about the so-called association between Antifa and journalism. But, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the same kind of mode of thinking. I mean, what the article sought to do was to say that these journalists were illegitimate because of the research they did, perhaps the supposed ideologies that they held, though there's not a lot of evidence as to what those ideologies actually were, or the fact that they simply write things that aren't very affirmative about racists. And so it was looking at a huge, huge range of really professional journalists and to do this for their job and singling them out for things that, frankly, humans should not be singled out for. And that went a lot further. You know, after we wrote the article, there was a complaint from the original author that we couldn't be objective anyway because of, you know, whatever they think our politics are. As if to be a journalist, you have to be a person without opinions, without any kind of civic engagement whatsoever. And then Andy Ngo has kind of continued this even further. And I think to a way that's just as kind of violently irresponsible. So recently we had a weekend that had two mass shootings in it. We had the one in El Paso that was very clearly tied to a white nationalist manifesto. No mystery there. We know exactly what it was. The second one happened in Dayton, Ohio, and there's a lot of mystery there. People actually don't know why that happened. There's not a lot of information about it. What people are able to glean from the shooter's social media was that they maybe had marginally left-leaning views, but also seemed to have deep, deep misogyny, which, you know, puts them into a long line of mass shooters. What Andy Ngo did was then look at that very, very little bit of marginal left-wing ideas and then created an article with the headline of, was the Ohio shooter the first Antifa, was the Ohio shooting the first Antifa mass shooting? There's no evidence to this fact. But all he had to do was make that assumption. And then what he did was found any journalist that essentially the shooter was following or maybe retweeted at some point and put them in there and like basically publicized that those people were, I don't even know what the assumption was, connected in some way in these tweets that basically lead people to then be threatened by a lot of Andy Ngo's very large following. Now, Andy has a lot of plausible deniability. He says, oh, I'm just asking questions. I was just wondering why that was happening. But he knows exactly what he's doing. He's putting people up to a point, making an assumption that somehow the shooter is connected to Antifa, and then that these journalists are then connected to the shooter, which makes a sense of responsibility. And it makes people viscerally angry. People react with rage much more so than logic in those situations. And we're talking about mainstream journalists and activists now are suddenly on the hook for the mass shooter, even though they have no connection to it whatsoever. And so I think that by doing this kind of activity, by making these sorts of like gossipy allegations, it puts people up for very real violence, because what he's doing is drumming up a significant amount of guttural rage and then throwing individuals into the fire of it.
Yeah, and I want to kind of point to this because I feel like so Shane, you were, for instance, I think it's awesome that you were on like Democracy Now! Actually recently. I wish that both of you would be interviewed more regularly or at all by, like, when all this shit happens, you know, when there is a mass shooting that's obviously tied to some white nationalist ideology, or when, you know, you have someone like Andy Ngo and all of these situations that he's been involved with, you know, it would be so great to have you or anyone like you that's doing this kind of work that each of you are doing and actually be interviewed by like a mainstream, you know, outlet. Like, I mean, why don't they have you on CNN? Why do they have Richard Spencer on CNN or whatever? Why do they have that guy there? Why don't they have you or some other person there that can actually bring that context? Because that seems to be so sorely missing, especially when we talk about mass shootings. And Shane and I, we've had this discussion at least a couple times about these so-called lone wolf attacks and how there's actually a much broader and deeper context here that's often not really addressed in the mainstream press. So if both of you had the opportunity, I mean, in this hypothetical situation where you're in, you know, being interviewed by some mainstream journalist, like, how would you want to gear that discussion? What would you bring up in each of your hypothetical interviews? So maybe I'll ask Alexander first, like, what kind of context would you like to bring to the table if you were to discuss this on a more national publication or news outlet of some sort?
I think I kind of just phrase it or frame it in terms of appeasement. It's like, you know, we have to fight against the encroaching presence of fascism in our everyday lives. We have to stop these organizations and this ideology from really gaining ground here, outside of the current presidential administration, which seems to be slipping increasingly toward sort of white nationalist policies in terms of immigration, at least. And so, you know, these are really hard, difficult sort of questions that we really need to sit with and understand and think about. We can't shrug it off. We can't just not take it seriously and expect it to go away. I mean, that is the most privileged position that I've been seeing, even on in some quarters of the left. And you know, great, you know, 5 years from now, you know, there's no more fascism and, you know, we can all laugh about it, you know, but, you know, when we look back, we'll say these were the people who were fighting it and who were actually making a difference, you know, and we'll think about the collaborators, you know, and the people who did nothing and just kind of shrug about it. You know, what else could we do? But right now, you know, we're fighting a winning battle and we're taking control. And so nothing is going to stop us. And, you know, it's just time for people to choose which side they're on. You know, there's no fence walkers here.
Mm. Okay. Shane, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think the first thing I think is interesting is, you know, we actually do go on a lot of mainstream, you know, I get interviewed by a lot of mainstream journalists, but what I think is funny about it is that the journalists who I get interviewed by very regularly also get the same attacks on them from right-wing press. So in a certain way, it's almost not like, it's any journalist that is going to look at these things critically or is going to make an assumption that fascism is not good, if that's going to be included in their kind of baseline worldview, is coming under assault right now. And so I think in a way there's a battle for what the basic frame of the issue is going to be. I mean, I think it's important that we constantly return to what the consequences of white nationalism actually is and where we actually are in it. You know, we're entering a phase of climate collapse, of economic decline, of very serious social issues. And the reaction from some quarters is to ignore it on the one hand and the other ones to create kind of a revolutionary reactionary movement. And we have to reckon with it because we are not going to have a choice. We're seeing a stage of mass shootings that are only increasing. We're seeing groups that, while sometimes they decline briefly, are growing internationally. We have to do something about it because if we don't, it's going to be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and I want to like kind of pull on this again, which is, so what is it about? So I feel like, you know, for instance, when you have Trump saying that, you know, it's video games or something that's causing mass shootings and kind of all these old tropes, these ideas that have been spun and used over and over again throughout the years since we've had this phenomenon of mass shootings in the United States. You know, the same ideas are kind of recycled over and over again. Of course, he doesn't want to delve into the actual, you know, deeper context like both of you provide, for instance. But I kind of want to put the spotlight on the way the media has presented this thing, whether it's mass shootings, whether it's these street fights, basically in Portland or wherever there's these mass, or, you know, Charlottesville, of course, is a great, pretty good example of this. I think the way that the corporate media just functions, because it is corporate, because it is a capitalist media, they don't necessarily have, I would even say, the ability to really delve deeply into the subject because of just the very way it's structured, the very way that it's being presented in this time of, like, I think, very short sound bites. Like, if, you know, if there's there's all of these examples of people being on CNN or these big news channels where they're just starting to get into the nitty gritty of the subject, and then the journalist will either try to direct the conversation in another direction, or they'll just shut the interview off before they can even get to it. And I just feel like there's something about the media itself that's just completely incapable, and not just unwilling, but incapable of really addressing this. And that's where I think it's a bit dangerous, because, you know, there really isn't resources for many people that aren't really familiar with anti-fascist politics, that don't really understand the context on the ground. They're not there in Portland. They don't see Proud Boys beating up people indiscriminately in the street. You know what I mean? They don't have that context. So I want to maybe ask this to both of you, in which the ways in which the media and how it is structured today can possibly have space and room, just like we saw with Andy Ngo, create space and room for these types of grifters, these various media personalities to, you know, basically like, be a part of this fascist creep, you know, and I kind of want it to be understood that within a capitalist system and sort of this idea that we have about how media is supposed to work in this time, that actually it kind of opens the door and leaves space for these types of groups to thrive. So I don't know how to frame that within a question properly. I hope I articulated my point well enough. But if Alexander, if you had any thoughts on that, on the nature of corporate media and how it actually allows room for these types of kind of fascist ideologies to seep into the public discourse.
So I think it's complex. You know, I have friends who, you know, have written for NBC or CNN or, you know, the Washington Post and whatnot. And I think that sometimes, you know, there's excellent work being put out. You look at like some of the frontline stuff about Adam Waffen. I mean, that's some pretty good hard-nosed reporting. And a lot of times, unfortunately, even when you do have really good reporting, it's not really sort of credited to the right sources, because the people who are, like, as you kind of, you know, implied there, the people who are doing like significant amounts of research into these groups are actually, you know, very secretive, anonymous groups that, you know, absolutely would not want to be named in any articles in the national media. So, you know, that's in itself a kind of a structural quagmire. It's like, why can't real credit go to the people who are doing the most research here? Why does it go to journalists who are free to cherry pick and are still getting targeted, you know? But as you sort of go up the chain, I think you do get disconnected from, you know, the beat reporters who know more about the detail. And, you know, the more disconnected you get and the more sort of like this feeling of privilege you get, you know, you start to cater more, you know, like Barry Weiss or something, to this notion that this is all discourse that could happen in the public square, and whoever is sort of like obstructing it, you know, doesn't have sufficient faith in humanity and doesn't believe that, you know, we're all smart enough to, you know, suss out right from wrong and fact from fiction, you know. And so you get this kind of very abstract sort of liberal universalism that sees movement building really as simply a question of, you know, making speeches or even just making conversation. You know, so I think that it's important to look at hierarchy specifically in the structure and how it plays into a disconnection from the everyday, you know, body bag list and plays more into the hands of real, you know, people who are actually organizing. And the biggest example, to close this out, the clearest example of this would be how Jake Trapper basically indicted all of Antifa for beating up every journalist in the United States after, you know, what happened to Andy Ngo on Twitter, and then invited Richard Spencer onto his program, and then, you know, a couple of weeks later was, you know, publicly tweeting out how sorry and sad he was about the El Paso shootings. And you're really not connecting the dots at this point, you know? You're undermining opposition to fascism, you're promoting a fascist leader, and then when, you know, exposure of fascism sort of percolates into this, you know, bloodbath, then, you know, you can go issue your thoughts and prayers to the victims. You know, that's not how it works. And I'd really like to see people who are free to opine, you know, on national media without really getting their hands dirty. I'd really like to see them actually work a beat and do some real hard-nosed journalism before they're able to, you know, make these broad claims.
Shane?
Yeah, I think to some degree it's the same issue that we're having in right-wing media. Sort of, there's a culture in some of those outlets of people who, frankly, aren't very well educated on issues, given platforms to pontificate about them. There's a lot of really good beat reporters covering this who know it really well because they cover it quite a bit. They write a great deal about it. And so they're able to speak about it in a really nuanced way with a lot of background. But a lot of people aren't. We're talking about complicated issues where you need a great deal of background to be able to put things in context. Otherwise, it might actually look like two sides are just fighting it out every summer, when in reality, we have a long, long history of these groups coming here and community organizations trying to defend themselves in the community, which is a much different story than we hear a lot of times. I think that, like, there is a culture of arrogance in certain journalistic circles about the importance of journalism versus organizing, and to kind of portray activists and organizers in suspect ways, or people who are behaving silly or without merit. And I think that's a culture that should be challenged and is challenged in a lot of circles of journalism. And then I think the other part is just that a lot of large media outlets just don't have the capacity to do background and serious stories in the way that a lot of journalists may like to. And this is, you know, this plays a lot more in really fast turnover cycles, particularly in TV, cable news, and things like that. And so I try not to put it actually on journalists in a lot of ways. There's a lot of journalists writing for really mainstream publications. Sasha and I have written for large publications, and they try to do their best. I think there is a real issue, though, when they have to find kind of sensational angles on coverage to be able to get people to read stories. And then deal with just kind of the fast production process of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It just seems to be the nature of the way news is generated or, you know, spread now. It's just like to do that sort of type of that kind of journalism and read those articles and to dig deeply it's sort of a product of our time of just sort of not having that attention span. And I mean, there's a feedback loop there. It's a combination of a lot of different things, but I just think it kind of speaks to this sort of surface level, decontextualized understanding of how events are playing out right now. And so, there was something I wanted to ask before we wrap this up. Cause I really want to tie this into why I think this is a dangerous thing. So sort of hearkening back to, you know, hashtag Antifa terrorists, or Antifa terrorism, however that was said, there was an article you published, Shane, not very long ago for Waging Nonviolence. Title of that was Right-Wing Media is Creating the Antifa Shooter Narrative Out of Thin Air. You discuss how Senator Ted Cruz introduced a resolution to label the movement Antifa as a quote quote domestic terrorists, and then something Donald Trump then supported via tweet saying are setting up a false dichotomy that has since been used to make broad attacks against activists and journalists. So yeah, I mean, I remember that tweet when Trump was like, you know, we're watching Portland very closely, you know, and we'll see what happens. And so I want to ask, you know, in both of your minds, are we at that stage of, I guess, whatever you want to call this, sort of a proto-fascist or at the very least just a kind of an authoritarian or something like that, where you have a president wanting to push forward some sort of legislation that could label Antifa, which is, by the way, there's no group that's just Antifa. It's a platform. It's an ideology. It's a way of kind of approaching politics and activism. So there's no like Antifa. It's just sort of, you know, it's like, how would you even define that? Which I think is the dangerous thing here, partially because if they create some sort of legislation saying that Antifa is a terrorist group or some sort of dangerous group, I mean, that's open to interpretation, right? So I wanted to know if there's been any more updates regarding that, if you too see that as a possibility of there being a real kind of any sort of legislation or some sort of policy or something like that, which would label, quote, Antifa as a terrorist group, and what the implications of that would be if something like that were to pass. So I'll ask Shane first if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I think the question of whether or not we're moving in the direction of a fascist state or a right-wing authoritarian one, I think it actually might be different than this question. The state in general finds ways of criminalizing, destabilizing social movements, and that goes back decades. I think this is particularly unique to this one because it's particularly unique to the time we're in, where a large portion of the mass movements we're seeing are anti-fascist in nature, and because Trump's base is basically in the crosshairs of a lot of anti-fascist movements because of their far-right characters. So there's a direct connection to the president this time. Whether or not they criminalize it, I think we should have nuance about how we talk about that, because the likelihood is they're not going to pass a bill that makes it illegal. It probably won't look like that. Instead, it will look like a myriad of changes, some in policy, some in procedure, whereby police departments may focus in on anti-fascist activists more. They might be a little bit more heavy-handed in how they treat protests and things like that. They might use RICO charges to try and go after groups of organizers suggesting that there's a criminal conspiracy. They might use Joint Terrorism Task Force like they have against environmental activists. There's a whole range they could do it. So, for example, you know, just here in Portland, police recently just went and flipped a person's house, raided it, and arrested them on a number of suspicion of felony charges. This happened just after this last protest, even though, for example, nothing at that protest seemed to really stand out in comparison to a lot of the violence you saw at other protests. So I think there was already a direction at trying to nail down anti-fascist activists more. That doesn't always require a very distinct legal change. In fact, it can be a cultural change. And if what Trump is doing and what Ted Cruz are doing are really cynical political ploys at this point, but they're going to have a very real effect in the way they shift discourse. If they tweet stuff like that out like that, it gets their base talking about it, which puts a climate of pressure on the police departments and the FBI and all kinds of judicial procedures to use that kind of enhanced tactics. And so I think that's what the effect could be. And I think that's happening.
Okay. Alexander?
Yeah, I think that really it's kind of like they're looking for the moment for the chilling effect. You know, they really want to kind of like create a big scene that's going to end up, you know, tamping down a lot of people's ability to participate. And that's really what we saw. I mean, the closest sort of analogy I could think of, and one that I think Shane has used before, is the what was referred to as the Green Scare.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of really FBI campaign against the Earth Liberation Front from, I don't know what, like 1999, I guess, in Long Island was maybe one of the first sort of investigations, all the way down to like, say, 2009 with the incarceration of Marius Mason and Eric McDavid. And what they did was they created a terrorism sort of add-on to the end of a sentence. So if you were convicted of something and, you know, in the process of some kind of eco-terrorist, you know, action according to the courts, then you would get an additional sentence, right? That was one big thing. Another one was just mass surveillance. I mean, there was a report released about 8 years ago that showed that the FBI was tailing random Subaru Foresters after a farmer's market in Eugene, Oregon, you know? So, you know, there's mass surveillance, grand juries, and there are sort of punitive tactics in terms of where people are incarcerated. Daniel McGowan was put in a communications management unit, which is heavily monitored in terms of who you're able to contact and talk to. Eric McDavid was handed something like a 20-year sentence for a crime that he didn't even commit, and they later threw it out and basically said that his charge was bunk in the first place after he spent years and years in prison. So these are chilling tactics that they can use on activist movements and have used on activist movements in the sort of recent past. And I think that that's really what people are kind of worried about, what they're sort of looking at and I think strategizing about, you know, what to do if this shoe starts to drop, you know. But on the other hand, with Trump, you know, his base is very sloppy, and the sort of Breitbart contingent is already starting a kind of disinfo campaign war against journalists, against actually mainstream journalists. And so, you know, as you know, the far right goes, you know, they want to, as Shane and I are intimately aware of, they'll go after just about anybody, you know, in that kind of McCarthyite sort of fashion.
And I think that actually, ironically, sort of throws us in the same boat as people with a lot more power than, you know, anybody in the anti-fascist camp or what have you necessarily has. So, you know, I think that there's a mass movement out there, and, you know, the Trump administration is caught between playing to their base and antagonizing some kind of like insurrection on the one hand, and then on the other hand, trying not to go too far and aggravate people, you know, even more than they already have. But, you know, so the political tools that are available to them are, I think, being kind of constricted, even as their base sort of calls out for more rage. And that's the big problem and the big question mark looking to the future, looking to 2021, is, you know, what's going to happen with this insurgent base that Trump has developed?
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the question. I mean, there's a lot of people have opinions about, you know, what if he wins the next election? Of course, there's that question. Or if he doesn't win, and I mean, who knows what he'll do as a reaction? I mean, there's all kinds of interesting comments that people close to Trump have made. I remember his lawyer, Cohen, right, was some sort of congressional hearing. And there was a comment he made, which is rather disturbing. He said something about how he was worried. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he was worried about what people, his base of followers, Trump supporters, would do if he didn't win the election. I think it was something like that. And I remember, like, I think Roger Stone made another similar comment. So I think... you know, having a strong anti-fascist kind of coalition and just really robust organizing is incredibly important, especially within that understanding of what could happen in light of maybe Trump losing an election or something like that. So it's important to have that framework there. So I wanted to ask you both here, maybe just one last question here, which is, you know, are you two like going to be working on any upcoming pieces together? Do you have anything in the works right now? Because I know you two have collaborated before. I mentioned at least one article that you two have done together. I like doing this, just knowing that both of you are out there working together. Do you have anything currently that you're both working on?
I mean, we just we're both kind of exhausted because we've been working on this one article that's been going through peer review all year. And it's just like, it's been a lot of archival research, you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of stuff in it. You know, it's just an exhausting process. But hopefully, fingers crossed, it'll be published sometime early next year.
Okay.
I'm working on two anthology books that I'm editing, and Sasha is in both of them, so we're doing that together.
Wonderful. Yeah, you both work very hard, just seeing how much content each of you put out, and I just want to mention both of your books. Alexander, you're the author of Against the Fascist Creep. Shane, you are the author of Fascism Today: What It Is and How to End It. And I just want to mention both of your websites. I know, Alexander, you're at alexanderreedross.net. You're also on Twitter at @AReedRoss. And Shane, I just want to say that you have started a Patreon account, which I would suggest anybody that's interested in supporting your work, that is a great place to go. I think the minimum you can do is like $3 a month, which is really nothing. I mean, that's like a coffee, you know. And they can go to patreon.com/ShaneBurley. And you're also on Twitter at @Shane_Burley1. Is there anything else that I'm missing there? I really want to make sure people can find your work, know where to go. Both of your books are published by AK Press. Is there anything else that I could share with the listeners?
I don't think so. Not on my end.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I was saying to Shane, like I've been wanting to talk with you. I think back when I started the podcast, I think I started the podcast a long time ago, but when I started doing interviews, which was like 3 or so years ago, you were certainly like on the list. And then somehow I got subsumed in all this other stuff and it just pulled me away. So I have to say, like, it's great to finally talk to you. Thank you for agreeing to do this, man. I really, really appreciate it. And as I was saying to Shane before we started, that I'll be traveling here pretty soon. I'm going up to Washington for about 3 weeks here next week. And then I think at the beginning of October-ish, end of September, early October, I want to drive down to Oregon, and hopefully I can meet you and Shane, and maybe we could make something of that. We could just hang out, or maybe do an interview or something. I just want to figure out something so we can all, like, connect. But yeah, it was really great to have you both on. Thank you both so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Always great to come on.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, and you can treat that like a bit of a tip jar. If you like this episode, or any other episode of this podcast in particular, consider throwing a few bucks Patrick's way. That would really be helpful. And if you would really like to sustain this work and support this project more regularly, consider supporting this project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release. And you will also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. As the great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."